hearing this afternoon of the human resources, and well, this is the Ways and Means subcommittee. And today we're going to hear from a Vocational Rehabilitation Division, and hopefully also from the Commission on the Blind. But we'll start with Vocational Rehabilitation. And this is House Bill 5029, so we'll open that public hearing. And John, why don't you familiarize us with our
Thank you, Senator Tutub. I wanted to raise a couple of issues for you and the committee to be aware of when you are listening to the testimony on the Commission for the Blind and the Vocational Rehabilitation Division. And during the last legislative session, during the budget hearing for the Vocational Rehabilitation Division, there was discussion about the funding, the federal funding split between the Commission for the Blind and the Vocational Rehabilitation Division. They share a common federal funding source, and the result of that discussion was that the Department of Administrative Services was asked to do a study on the funding split. Staff did that study and presented it to the Emergency Board in June. The Emergency Board did not acknowledge the report at that particular time. Instead, DAS made some revisions to the report to show how the Commission for the Blind should reach a national average of the funding split for commissions that are separate from the regular vocational rehabilitation program. 25 states have separate programs, 25 obviously do not. For those that do have separate programs, the national average is 15% of the federal funding going to the commissions for the blind and the remaining amount going to the Vocational Rehabilitation Division. In any case, the Emergency Board in September acknowledged receipt of the DAS study, but it is still an issue, and one of the things that LFO and also DAS committed to do was to raise that issue and to schedule these two agencies consecutively so that we could air that issue out and make a policy decision about it. The second point I wanted to make is that the federal funds that I just mentioned, which are in statute with the 1973 Rehabilitation Act, require state match. They match about $3.70 of federal funds to every dollar of state funds. And as it stands, the Voc Rehab Division does not have enough general fund or other funds to match all the available federal funds that are on the table. That situation may be remedied through an employment initiative that is currently within the Senior and Disabled Services Division budget, and we're going to hear that budget next week. But simply put, it would require SDSD to transfer some funds to the Vocational Rehabilitation Division so that they could match all the available federal dollars that is available to Oregon. One of the reasons, in fact, the primary reason that the vocational rehabilitation is short on general fund is that up through the early 90s, or beginning in the early 90s, up through the current biennium, Voc Rehab has been receiving some workers' comp funds from the Department of Business and Consumer Services, about $775,000, and they have been able to use those funds to match federal dollars. In June, I believe it was, MLAC, and I've got to figure out what that stands for, Management Labor Advisory Committee recommended that transfer of funds be discontinued. And so the governor's recommended budget does not assume a transfer or a continuation of that program. So consequently, Voc Rehab is short on its state funding match source. The rest of the week looks something like this. We are hoping to have public testimony tomorrow, and then response from the agencies to begin Thursday, and a work session on the Commission for the Blind's budget. After Voc Rehab is done with their presentation, my proposal is that Lisa Pearson from the Department of Administrative Services present the governor's recommended budget, and then we follow the same procedure for the Commission for the Blind. Thank you.
Thank you, John. Okay, then are you William Brown? Welcome,
Thank
Mr.
you.
Brown.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Bill Brown, and I'm the acting administrator of the Vocational Rehabilitation Division. With me today is Lene Rutledge, our assistant administrator for policy and planning. The mission of the Vocational Rehabilitation Division is to assist Oregonians with disabilities to achieve and maintain independence. And the division administers two major programs, rehabilitation services, which is a program that assists people with disabilities to get jobs, and the Disability Determination Services program, where we adjudicate supplemental security income and Social Security disability insurance claims for the federal government. On page 3 of your synopsis is a very general description of rehabilitation services and disability determination services. And what we would like to do today is to discuss our two programs with you, changes in the budget from 97-99 to 99-01, and then a couple of the major issues which John touched on earlier that affect the budget for 99-01. So first, if I may, I'd like to review the rehab services program. The basic vocational rehabilitation program encompasses all but about 2% of the rehabilitation services budget, so I'll focus my remarks on this program. As I said earlier, it's a program about jobs for Oregonians with disabilities. The budget for this program is $62 million for the biennium. The money is allocated to the states by the federal government based on population. The money comes from Title I of the Rehabilitation Act, and it is matched at just under $4 federal for every one state general or other fund available, which is a very favorable match ratio for the program. Oregon receives approximately 1% of the federal allocation, and the budget includes money for case service dollars, for the purchase of services on behalf of our clients, professional rehabilitation counselors, support staff, management, and services and supplies. The clients that we serve present any number of disabling conditions, such as orthopedic disabilities, mental illness, mental retardation, deafness, head injuries, para and quadriplegia. There's some client profiles on pages 5 and 6 of the budget synopsis. You'll note with respect to age that about 77% of our clients are between the ages of 20 and 50. And about two-thirds of them have high school education or less. On page 6, there's the graph on the top shows the percentage of individuals in the caseload and what they identify as their primary disabling condition. You'll note that orthopedic disabilities is the highest percentage of individuals that we serve, but fully at least a third of the individuals have some kind of a mental or emotional problem, and most of the individuals that we serve present at least two, if not more, of these kinds of disabling conditions. As John said earlier, the only major disabling condition the division does not serve is Oregonians with legal blindness, and you will hear later today from Mr. Young, who's the Director of the Commission for the Blind regarding his program. 96% of the consumers that we serve are severely disabled. By federal, the simplest way to describe that is that people have multiple disabling conditions and need multiple services in order to become rehabilitated. Oregon has one of the highest percentages of people with severe disabilities served in any agency in the country. Our eligibility criteria for the program are three, and I want to emphasize that our program is an eligibility program. The services that we provide are time-limited in nature. There must be a diagnosable mental or physical condition. That condition must be an impediment to employment, and the individual must require vocational rehabilitation services to get a job. These decisions are made by rehabilitation counselors that are located in offices throughout the state. Back on page four, if I may, of the synopsis is the rehabilitation process, and I would like to just go over that briefly with you, if I may.
Mr. Brown, before you do go on, is there you just named for us what makes a person eligible? Is that listed somewhere in this book?
Yes, it is. It's on, Madam Chair, it is on page four, right up at the very top. See it up there? Who's eligible?
Okay.
Mm-hmm. The application stage of the process cannot take longer than 60 days by law. There has to be an eligibility decision made within that period of time. And during that stage, our counselors gather information, medical information, employment information, employment history, or whatever it takes to help us plan effectively with the client. In the division, these decisions are made in approximately 37 days at this point in time. After eligibility is determined, the counselor and the consumer develop a rehabilitation plan leading to employment, and what services there are necessary in order to get to that vocational goal. The division contracts with public and private sectors, such as with community rehabilitation programs, as an example, to provide many of the services. Examples of services purchased may include work evaluations, work adjustments, training, job development, perhaps vocational technical training. After the completion of a program, the consumer either gets a job on his or her own, or we can assist them get the job. For federal purposes, a person cannot be rehabilitated unless he or she works successfully in a job for 90 days. That's the criteria, the federal criteria. Many of our clients are followed in employment for longer periods of time in order for us to ensure success. The average time that a consumer that is rehabilitated is in our system is about 14.3 months. So you can get some idea of the length of time that we're involved with consumers. Some are with us less than that, and others are longer, depending upon the program that may be developed on their behalf. Our survival rate to rehabilitation, which is a success rate, you might call a success rate, is running right at 70%. What that means is that out of every 10 consumers that we develop a rehabilitation program for, 7 of them are closed successfully in employment. To give you some perspective, the national percentage is about 61 or 62%, so we're running above the national average with respect to that rate.
Madam Chair, Mr. Brown, on the, you say consumer, the span of time that you work for them is about 14 months. That's right. Well, so are you saying that these are jobs that are just for a special project and they hire someone through Voc Rehab?
Madam Chair, Representative Loken, the 14 months is the amount of time on average that it takes us to evaluate, train, and place, and those jobs are jobs that we're hopeful that the consumer will keep for a long, long time and begin a successful employment career.
Misunderstood what you were pointing out there. Thank you.
There's a comprehensive list of services identified on page 7 of the budget synopsis to give you some idea of the kinds of things that we do. I want to emphasize that the primary service that we provide is vocational counseling and guidance. And vocational counseling and guidance is given to all consumers, where we work with them to determine what the most appropriate vocational goal would be, considering their skills and their interests and their limitations. We also purchase skills training. We look to do on the job training, where we'll work directly with an employer to have an individual learn skills on the job. We do rehabilitation technology, physical and mental restoration, and a whole series of possible services, whatever it takes to get a consumer employed. In terms of how our services are organized, we have 28 field offices located around the state, and in addition, we have staff that are outstationed all over around the state, many in DHR sister agency offices, mental health clinics, schools, one-stop centers. Lots of times we're involved in the employment service. And services are organized so that we can get to anyone within an hour if we need to, except in the very remote areas of southeastern Oregon, it's problematic there. We have 121 professional counselors and approximately 30 support staff who provide direct services to consumers. The responsibilities of the support staff have changed since we implemented, since we automated our case management system, and it has helped us get more individuals directly involved with consumers in the service delivery end, and has helped us serve more people. Each counselor is given a budget, which he or she manages, of approximately $100,000 per year. And with that money, the counselors are expected to serve approximately 125 to 150 persons. They maintain an active caseload at any one time of between 70 and 90. I think our average is something like 77 or 75. We also ask each of the counselors to develop at least 40 original rehabilitation programs, which are plan ones, new programs for people leading toward employment. That we ask them to do at least 40 of those and to rehabilitate at least 24 individuals per year. The division provides services in conjunction with a multitude of partners throughout the state. And in many cases, these partners allow us to leverage resources on behalf of clients so that we can do more for them. We will talk further in a few minutes about these partnerships. Some of them are exciting, very interesting, and very successful. We have an extremely successful partnership with the schools program, which Lene will share with you just very briefly in a couple of minutes.
Madam Chair. Mr. Brown, you say you have about $100,000 allowed for each counselor, and the counselor counsels between 100 to 150 people?
Per year, yes.
So that allows about, what, $700 per person that they can spend to help this person go back to work.
Madam Chair, Senator Yee, that's close to being accurate. That's one of the reasons why we try to work with partners to leverage resources so that we can extend the limited dollars that we have in on behalf of people. Some people we don't necessarily spend hardly any money on. Others we may spend considerable amount on. So the bottom line is that our counselors have to manage that total figure over a 12-month period of time, and they manage it. That we have reports that can tell us on a monthly basis exactly how much money we spent and for what, as a matter of fact. So it's not a lot of money.
Another question. I want to know if somebody comes in and say, for example, he or she wants to become a water treatment lab work person, and that would take about 8 months of training. So that probably would cost, I don't know, $1,000 or $2,000. So what do you do in a case like that?
Madam Chair, Senator Yee, if it looks like that individual can succeed in that kind of an employment objective, we would work with that person to achieve that goal. Mm-hmm. And what we do, like I said before, is that we get reports on a monthly basis so we know exactly where we are in terms of the budget. But that's a very good example of something that we might do for an individual if their abilities and aptitudes met that kind of a goal and looked like they could be successful, we would do that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, you have that kind of budget to help the person mm-hmm. even go to 6 or 8 months of training.
That's correct. Yes, we do. We just have to balance it amongst the total amount of referrals that we get. But, yes, that's very, very possible.
Mm-hmm.
I'd like to just briefly talk about program outcomes and the numbers that I'm going to give you are for calendar year 1998, because that's in the middle of this biennium, and it can give you an idea of about what we do on an annual basis. In calendar year 1998, we served 17,131 Oregonians with disabilities. The 97-99 budget called for services to approximately 23,000 consumers, and in actuality, we're going to serve closer to 25,000. We are on target to develop over 8,000 original plans, employment plans for people with disabilities, and to close approximately 5,300 people in employment, in successful employment outcomes. During the calendar year of 1998, we rehabilitated 3,115 individuals. And that's an increase of 28% when compared to the previous year, and that's without any new staff. The remaining people that are on the active caseload are in various stages of the rehab process. Some are in the evaluation stage. Some may be in training. Some may be in jobs. So it's a process where people come in the front end, are involved with us, and then go in the back end, and it evolves all the time. In 1998, just to give you a little more perspective, we averaged 744 referrals per month coming into our agency. That was up from 685 in 1997. During the first 3 months of 1999, we have averaged 867 referrals. So the demand and the interest in services is escalating rapidly.
Okay. So, why is that? What's your hunch about why you're getting a lot more referrals?
Well, Madam Chair, Representative Ross, I think there's a number of reasons that I could share with you. One is that we have really turned our focus toward jobs. We really push for jobs first. When an individual comes in to see us, we talk jobs, not training necessarily, although we do training, but we talk jobs first. Secondarily, there's been cutbacks in other programs, other human services programs, which generally mean more referrals to us. Thirdly, we have one of our major initiatives is a world-class customer service program, and we have increased our outreach to people. And people are learning more about us and about the successes, I believe, that we have. The other thing is, that I would say is that our involvement with partners generally means more individuals requesting services. But the demand is escalating, we're able through a number of efficiencies that we've done to be able to meet the demand so far. But it's getting pretty hectic at this point in time, and we get referrals from a number of places. We get them from almost all of the sister agencies within the Department of Human Resources. We get them from the Employment Department. We get them from private agencies, mental health clinics, schools, doctors, family members. Some people just walk in and request services. So we get referrals from just about every place you can imagine. Another point that I wanted to mention to you was that over 60% of the people who we serve are involved in other human services programs. So if we can get these individuals to work, we can reduce the burden on other human service systems as well. Just another example I could give you is over 30% of our referrals come from Adult and Family Services. So we work very closely with Adult and Family Services in terms of putting people, working with people with disabilities and getting them jobs. On page 9 are some of our performance measures, accountability measures, and I'd like to just touch briefly on a couple of those, if I may. One of the things that we do is we listen to our customers. We need to listen to them. We do satisfaction surveys on a regular basis, and we do them on a agency-wide basis, and we do them, many of the offices do them on individual basis. And what we found is that 78% of the consumers in the latest survey group that we did, which encompasses, I believe, a 6-month period of time, 78% of the consumers said that they were satisfied or better with the services provided by the division. And we're always looking to figure out ways to do things better, and what better way is there but to listen to your consumers. Another one is the self-sufficiency, the consumer self-sufficiency. And what that one does is it compares the average entry-level wage of the vocational rehabilitation consumers compared to the average Oregon workforce entry-level wage. Now, the latest data that we have shows that the average Oregon entry-level wage is $8.68 an hour. Our latest information shows $8.24 an hour is the average wage at closure of the consumers that we closed successfully rehabilitated. And we've been up as high on a quarterly basis as $8.76, which I think is the highest, $8.76 per hour, but our latest data is $8.24 per hour. The last one that I want to mention is the one on the bottom of the page, and that's what we call a job retention rate. And what we look at there is the percentage of consumers who are employed 2 years after we close their case. And I think that's a measure of you know, how good a job you really do. If people lose their jobs in 3 months or whatever, I mean, how good is it that you've done? In our case, the current amount of individuals who are still employed after 24 months is 69%.
Before you go on, Mr. Brown, let me ask you a couple questions. You gave us some statistics just before you went to page 9, although I was taking notes on that page while you were doing that. And Representative Ross asked a question about why the referrals were up. I don't know whether you were encompassing all of the statistics you gave, but you gave us some pretty positive things that you were doing, one of which is the number that have been employed, and there's a 23% or placed, I think, 3,115,
yes.
And that is a 23% increase over the last year. Now, why is that? Are you doing something different there now that do you have a different sort of a vision, maybe a different way of accomplishing what you're doing?
Madam Chair, the answer to that question is yes, and I was going to cover that in just a couple of minutes. It has to do with how we've changed the way we've done business as part of our vision in terms of world-class customer service. I'll be glad to get to that. Okay, thank you. Just some comparisons briefly to calendar year 97 versus calendar year 98, a little bit more information about demand. The active caseload that we have today is about 5.1% higher than it was in 97. The rehabilitations, as we mentioned, were 28% higher. The number of original plans written were 10.7% higher. The number of referrals, which are the people that are coming into our system that Representative Ross was asking about, is up about 12.3%. And the number of people served in total is up about 7.1%. And as we talked earlier, just a few minutes ago, we talked about the multitude of partners in our work and in some of our major initiatives. And these, a number of these partners are mentioned on pages 10 and 11 of your budget synopsis. And I'd like to ask Lene to discuss these some of these partnerships, some of these key partnerships with you, if I may.
Thanks. Again, for the record, my name is Lene Rutledge, and I'm the Assistant Administrator for Planning and Policy with Vocational Rehabilitation Division. I'm chairkeeper of the members of the committee. As Bill was talking about, we really believe that partnerships is what makes the business of vocational rehabilitation successful. The language in the rehabilitation law talks about the partnership between vocational rehabilitation and the person that serves. People have to jointly agree to a plan for their employment outcomes. They have to be involved in the delivery of services. They have to be involved in our policies. They have to be involved in the way we deliver rehabilitation services. So that partnership between the person who comes for services in both rehab is real important to us. When Bill was talking about the number of dollars that we're able to leverage from our other partner organizations, it's real substantial. So when we spend an average of $700 on a case, most often that's leveraging thousands of other dollars that the person may be able to get from financial aid or from another organization. And that's really what we put together as the Partnership for a Rehabilitation Plan. You heard when the department did its overview, the Department of Human Resources has fully engaged us as divisions as well as our partners in the community to look at what the goals should be of the Department of Human Resources. And the two goals that Voc Rehab provides the most substantial input to relate to increasing the number of adults served by DHR that go to work. Because what we're doing is helping people support themselves, which is one of the goals, and helping people live as independently as possible. And that's really the essence of the Rehabilitation Services Program and Disability Determination. But as I said, the nature of what we do means that we partner extensively with people with disabilities and with their families and with the community to assure that we provide efficient, effective, and accountable services. You're going to hear from a number of people tomorrow who are going to give testimony talking about the impact of vocational rehabilitation services. So you can get a real personal picture of the folks that we serve. What I'd like to do is just spend a few minutes looking at pages 10 and 11 in your synopsis document to help you, again, get more of that personal perspective. At the top of page 10, where it says coordination and collaboration with other partners, it starts by describing that relationship between consumers and the counselor as they develop a plan for employment. We have a state rehabilitation council, which is appointed by the governor, that has a majority of people with disabilities. It has representatives from the community. It has representatives from business who provide us with input and advice about the direction that rehabilitation services is going. We are actively involved with the state independent living council and at a local level with local advisory committees. And you're going to meet some of those members tomorrow. Because these are people with disabilities and their partners who come and want to be a part of the rehabilitation process and want to contribute to the way we do business in Oregon. Some of the people that you're going to meet are folks who have been employed because of our services in your community. Places like the Albany Boys and Girls Club. I was looking at the last quarterly report of the employers that we place people with. And wanted to look at places that you would recognize. Murray Hill Thriftway, Eastmoreland Hospital, Oregon State University, the City of Portland, the Police Department. Across people's communities, folks are becoming employed as a result of our services. In addition, what we do is we work with more than 140 community rehabilitation programs who are a real major partner in the way we do business. And again, it's places like the Clackamas Challenge Center and Bonnie Enterprises and Central Oregon Resources for Independent Living, places in your community where people can go who have severe disabilities and help learn the skills that they need to become employed. we partner with high schools, with community colleges, with universities, with medical doctors, with mental health clinics, as well as companies that provide assistive technology and prosthetic devices. And we do all of that because, again, we understand that working in partnership is the way that people with disabilities can get the most effective services. If you look at the bottom of page 10, it explains partnerships with a specific program focus. Bill had mentioned the Youth Transition Program. During this biennium, we'll serve 1,200 students with disabilities who are in the YTP, the Youth Transition Program. This is a relationship with a local school district where that school district helps us to leverage federal funds. What we do is provide then a new pattern of service in that school district where we now have transition specialists. We have people that are working with students with disabilities, assisting them to become employed when they leave school. In addition, we have relationships with the Mental Health and Developmental Disability Services Division, primarily in the provision of supported employment services for folks with developmental disabilities or mental illness. We work closely with Senior and Disabled Services Division. When John was giving the overview earlier in his presentation, he talked about the package that would assist us in leveraging additional federal funds. We've been working together with the Senior and Disabled Services Division, working with folks who have a barrier to employment, and that barrier to employment has been that they can't afford to lose their Medicaid coverage. These are individuals with severe disabilities that need health care and long-term services. And without that benefit, they are not able to become employed. What we've done is partnered with Senior and Disabled Services to be able to look at a new way that those individuals could go to work. And it's through a state plan amendment to our Medicaid state plan. You'll hear more about that next week when SDSD does their budget presentation. We've also leveraged additional resources from the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation and the Rehabilitation Services Administration to help us be successful in that effort of matching employers and people with disabilities so that they can maintain their benefits and go to work. If you look to the top of page 11, we work closely with Adult and Family Services. We both have very much the same goal of wanting to assure that our mutual clients see employment as the outcome. Disability Determination Services, Lloyd Horsley is the assistant administrator. He'll be up right after me. He's going to talk about his relationships with two of our sister organizations within DHR, one of them being, again, Senior and Disabled Services, but also the State Office for Services for Children and Families, because they also are involved in Social Security benefits for children. The other workforce partners that we have are in the middle of page 11. Have really provided us with a way that employers can see us as a valued resource. We know that people need to go to work, and employers need to see themselves as being able to employ people with disabilities and do that successfully. So we partner with the Employment Department. We're active members of local community efforts with regional workforce committees. We're actively involved in one-stop career centers. We're actively involved in those partnerships because we want to do two things. We want to assure that people that come to VRD get the services that they need, but we also want to assure that those other organizations effectively serve all of the other people with disabilities who also want to go to work, but it might not be appropriate for them to come to us for services. They may be able to be effectively served by the Employment Department. They may be able to effectively get services from JTPA or from a local community college, and we want to be there to help them be able to do a good job. In conclusion, at the bottom of page 11, we tried to highlight what the linkages are with Oregon benchmarks, because, again, it's important to see how what we do helps Oregon be a better place to live. And obviously, we're involved in helping folks with disabilities become employed. And so it's going to increase the percentage of Oregonians who have a living wage and who get health insurance, who are individuals who are getting out of poverty and becoming employed. The spectrum of people that we work with, besides having a variety of disabilities, also come from a variety of different cultures. it's so important to us that the cultural diversity of the people that we serve reflects Oregon. So we want to make sure that our staff come from diverse cultures, that the service providers that we utilize are able to effectively serve people from diverse cultures, and that clients from diverse cultures feel welcome in our offices. And we believe that we've been making a real successful effort at doing that. If you don't have any questions, I'll turn it over to Roy Horsley so that he can do your overview on disability determination services.
Thank you. Another question? Thank you,
Madam Chair, before we get Lloyd on, I want to talk with you about your question that you had with regard to some of our major initiatives and why we were able to increase our performance. If you turn to page 12 in the budget synopsis, under major initiatives, we talk about a number of the issues that we're dealing with. And I wanted to highlight two of them for you, and one of them relates to the question that you asked. And it is what we call world-class customer service. Our vision includes the provision of world-class customer service. Several years ago, we decided that we wanted to be better, and we wanted to be the best. And to that end, we all received some training with regard to world-class customer service. Organizational actions that we've done relative to this concept, which is what you were asking, include such things as we have automated our case management system. And as we automated the case management system, we were able to change a number of jobs from that used to be clerical jobs to human resource aides or human resource assistants. So we increased the number of people within existing staff that provide direct services to people, so we have more people in touch with consumers. Each of the major operational units in the agency has a business plan which rolls up into the organization's business plan. We've done such things as in many areas we've tried to offer same-day service. If an individual walks in the office, in a rehab office, they are seen. They are seen by a counselor or a counselor of the day. They do not wait. They are not sent back home. I cannot say to you that it's 100% certain that that is happening all the way across the state, but in many, many places in the state that has happened. We have improved our access to people by outstationing. As we talked before, we outstation people around the community so that people have better access to us and we can deal with them more readily. We are paying attention to what consumers say about what their needs are, what they like about what we do, and what they don't like, and we're trying to change as we move along so that we can be more responsive to consumers. We've decentralized and changed some of our administrative resources and moved them out into the field so that we could provide additional training, guidance, and technical assistance, and administrative reviews to our counseling staff. We've empowered them. I know that's an overused word sometimes, but we have empowered our staff to make decisions. We've reduced levels of approval that we used to have, the bureaucratic levels of approval, depending upon the number or how much money it costs or any number of factors. We've reduced those. We've changed the role of our managers to coaches, mentors, helpers, rather than controller types of people that keep their thumb on the staff. We've initiated, Lloyd may be talking about this a little bit in his presentation, but we've initiated team approaches to service delivery. Some teams which are self-managed. And we've had mixed, I have to tell you that we've had mixed results with that, but we have had some very positive results in some cases. And the overall results are very striking. And this effort has offered all the challenges that you might expect in a situation where you're really trying to change a culture in an organization. And that's basically what we've done. We've tried to change the culture, but the results are exciting. And I believe that our people are energized. I think they like to come to work And the result is more timely and better services for Oregonians with disabilities, which is why we exist. And so we feel like, you know, we are serving more people. We're serving them faster. Our success rate is higher. The levels of satisfaction are good, and the costs are lower as a result of the number of people that we're serving. And I'm not going to sit here and tell you that we got a perfect agency, because we don't. We have our problems just like anybody else, but we're working at them, and the things that are important to us and important to people with disabilities are improving, and that's what I wanted to share with you with regard to your question.
Thank you. It is impressive to me to see the change, and so that's why I like to see what has happened, and I have seen this happen in some other agencies where they decide they're going to have a little bit of a culture change, and it actually does work.
Mm-hmm.
That is good. I do have a question, and maybe we'll get to this later too. And if we do, I will wait for the answer to that. But I'm not sure whether it would even work. But you know, we have heard about employees, the tremendous turnover, for instance, in employees in long-term care situations, just different areas where there is a real need for steady employees. And I'm not sure that there would even be many maybe that would qualify that you work with, but I'm just wondering if sometimes when you see a need in the state, and when you hear that there's a 90% turnover in those employees and that kind of work, whether you attempt to try to do plans in that way to serve both the particular vocation that's in need of the help, and then sort of query your consumers, the clients that are coming in, to find out if that is an interest to them, and if it is possible for them to be trained if they have an interest. Of course, they would have to have an interest in this, but I don't know if you have an answer.
Madam Chair, we do labor market assessments as part of our job, and in areas where there's turnover and where people have the needs, we attempt to train them if that's necessary and place them in areas like that. I think that the state in general also looks at these kinds of things, and there is a real need. In vocational rehabilitation, our turnover, and I can get that for you if you're interested. I don't have that in the top of my head, but I could get that for you. It's not real bad, I think, in comparison to others. We're having some real good success with being able to retain employees, and retaining employees is another thing that allows you to get better and to improve rather than to have to spend all your time with turnover and retraining and that sort of thing. So it is an issue, and we do look at various labor markets as part of the role that the counselors do.
Okay.
I just want to follow up on the chair's question about what brought about this change. Yeah, you've always had a lot of good people in your organization. You've had stable administration. What was the stimulation that made you turn to saying you were going to have better customer service, you were going to do things differently? What was the beginning of that change?
Madam Chair, Representative Ross, it was a result of us doing some self-analysis, I think, at the executive level of the organization. And some of us had been involved in some training that we had done with a consultant that we used to help train us, that was very, very good. And we just part of our vision, we did some visioning and took a good look at our vision and decided that we needed to do some business planning and get more, get ourselves more organized and do better. We wanted to do better. We also looked at, some of the statistical data, and our statistical data has never been bad, but we wanted it to be better. And so we talked to our staff, we talked to consumers, we talked about some of the kinds of things that we wanted to do differently, and we've been able to I think really change the organization, and it's just not a It's you know, some people might say that it's a little loose. I don't believe in that, because the results are there, and they continue to be there, and the people that we're bringing into the organization are people that are very dynamic. They've had a lot of work experience in many cases with regard to dealing with employers and making cold calls and that sort of thing, which is something that our people do. But I guess I would, if I had to answer your question in one sentence, it would be, we did some self-analysis and decided we wanted to do better, and that's what started it.
I'm sure this is just very interesting, because we hear over and over that it's hard for big organizations to change, and this was a good organization, a stable organization, that took a lurch forward. And, you know, these numbers are, over the last 2 or 3 years, are up just dramatically from what happened before. So it's very interesting.
Well, I, Representative, I was a part of an organization that decided they were going to change, too, and I saw it happen. So I know it can, and that's why it is really good to see quantifiable results, too, to be able to say, not only do we have better morale and people are participating in a better way, we actually have the results of what we wanted to be better at, and show you that we are doing, you know, we are doing a better job because we're working together and maybe have a different method. And it doesn't say that anybody was not doing a bad job, like you have said. The point is that it, everybody can do better. And if they stop and take a look at themselves and say, is there another way we can do it, and are successful at that, we should reward that.
Yeah.
So. Appreciate it.
Madam Chair.
Sorry.
I want to ask a question about your customer satisfaction survey.
Mm-hmm.
And you say the satisfaction rating is 89% for employers and 78% for consumers. Now, is this an in-house survey, or is this an independent survey you contract out?
Madam Chair, Senator Yee, it's one that we developed in our research section, and we send out to not only employers, who we believe employers and consumers are our customers. And so we've developed an instrument. It's quite simple. In fact, we're looking to modify it at this point in time, but it's something that was developed in-house by our research person, and we use it to send out. If you'd be interested in taking a look at it, I'd be glad to provide you with examples of the two surveys, one to employers and one to clientele. If you'd be interested, we'll get that for you.
Follow-up question. Once you get a more objective viewpoint, is it done by an independent surveyor? Because we have people like Oregon State University that would do these kind of surveys. Because sometimes the way you ask your question can lead to certain kind of answer. So wouldn't it be more objective if you do these questions together with an outside agency for the survey?
Madam Chair, Senator Yee, I that's hard to argue with. I think that's a point well taken that we could certainly look at.
Mm-hmm.
We have not done that in these particular surveys to date, though.
Uh-huh. Another question.
Yes.
You know, OMAP, Oregon Health Plan, they do their own in-house survey also, mm-hmm. except for the dental customer satisfaction survey, who was contracted out with Oregon State University. Mm-hmm. And this is the reason I asked. Mm-hmm. I just thought survey may give you more objective mm-hmm. Survey is done by an outside.
I think that's a good observation. We can certainly consider that, yes.
Yes, because all these high ratings, and if it's done in-house, then people might think twice. Mm-hmm. Is that a real opinion mm-hmm. or not?
And Senator, I would agree that sometimes when somebody prepares the questions, often they have a client that you want to give an answer. And if that were the only measure that we have here, it might be suspect. But actually, when I see that the average wage or entry-level wage in Oregon is $8.68, and the average placement currently the average wage at closure of these folks is $8.24, that they're increasing, 23% increase over the last year of placement. There are other quantifiable numbers that actually show that there's satisfaction. And whether there's satisfaction or not, if people are in jobs, and, well, I mean, they should be satisfied in their job, but if they stay for 24 months or more, they're pretty satisfied. So I would say that I agree about what you're saying about in-house questions, and sometimes they can be planted in a way, and not only that, that the consumer or that the employer who might be getting employees from you might not want to make any waves, but there are other results that we have here that I think actually give us an idea of what they are producing. They're really producing something for that satisfaction.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would just like to mention one other initiative, and we've talked about this. John talked about it when they talked about it. I just want to mention it again. We are involved in the Department of Human Resources with this employment initiative, which is an attempt by the department to increase employment opportunities and jobs for people with disabilities. And VRD is involved in that, obviously, in a very collaborative way, primarily with SDSP, but also with other partners, to help very severely disabled people with very complex barriers that we might not normally serve because of the complexity of their barriers, to try to get those people jobs. And the initiative also involves intensifying relationships with employers, utilizing SDSP case managers as partners to assist with the provision of some services, and adds some additional services such as maybe longer-term follow-up after a person is in plan, with the hope, the obvious hope, again, of increasing that number of people who are working after 2 years longer. So that initiative is one also that I wanted to mention. In looking at the time, if it is okay, I'd like to introduce Lloyd Horsley to talk about the Disability Determination Program, and then I can kind of conclude with some brief discussions about the budget and the two budget notes, and, you know, hopefully within 25, 30 minutes maybe we'll be done, and then.
Okay, thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Lloyd Horsley. I'm an assistant administrator with the division, and my primary responsibility is the administration of the Disability Determination Services Program. And I'd like to refer you to page 13 of your synopsis and just give you a brief overview of the program.
13.
The purpose of the Disability Determination Services Program is to process all of the Social Security disability claims that are filed in the state of Oregon. And the DDS program contributes to the Oregon benchmarks for quality of life and for the economy by providing economic access to basic health care and personal income for Oregon citizens that are eligible for Social Security disability benefits. The Social Security Disability Program is a 100% federally funded program that is administered through each state. Disability claims are filed in a local Social Security office, and after federal personnel determine whether technical requirements are met, then those claims are forwarded to the State Disability Determination Services Office. And at the DDS, our responsibility is to determine whether or not the applicant meets the Social Security definition of disability. And to meet that definition, a claimant must have a medically determinable impairment that precludes all work activity for at least 12 consecutive months. At DDS, we're responsible for collecting the medical, vocational, and lay evidence that's needed to evaluate the claimant's alleged disability. We must analyze all the evidence and determine whether or not the claimant meets that Social Security definition of disability. After we make our determination, we then return the file back to the local Social Security office, and the Social Security Administration is actually responsible for administering the benefits for those people that are eligible. In Oregon, we adjudicate about 35,000 such claims each year. We have about 175 employees, including disability analysts and medical consultants. We're a centralized operation that's located here in Salem in the Department of Human Resources building. We process three different levels of disability claims. We process the initial claims, which are the first-time filings. We also process the reconsideration claims, which is the first appeal level. And then we also process continuing disability reviews to determine if the people that are currently on the rolls continue to be eligible for the benefits. Over the past few years, Congress has passed several pieces of legislation that has had quite an impact on our workload. In 1995 and 1996, Congress passed legislation that required the Social Security Administration and the state DDSs to review an additional 5.5 million continuing disability review claims. Other legislation that was passed prohibited eligibility to individuals whose drug addiction or alcoholism is a contributing factor to their disability. And welfare reform redefined disability for children and required all the state DDSs to redetermine whether current children receiving benefits were eligible in light of the new definition. In addition to these congressionally mandated changes, the Social Security Administration has decided to redesign the entire eligibility determination process in 1999. So that change, along with the federally mandated changes, will increase the workloads in the DDS and require additional training needs. I would like to take just a minute and talk about the redesigned disability process because this has such a dramatic impact on the way that we'll do business in the future. In 1994, the Commissioner of the Social Security Administration announced an initiative to redesign the process. The five primary objectives of the redesigned process are to make the process more user-friendly for the claimant, to make the right decision the first time, to make the decision as quickly as possible, to make the process efficient, and to make the work satisfying for the employees. Since the commissioner made that decision back in 1994, a few state DDSs, including the Oregon DDS and the Social Security Administration, has engaged in rigorous testing of various redesigned concepts. The results of these tests have showed the potential for improving customer service by focusing more attention at the initial claims level to improve the quality and to increase customer satisfaction at that level. The current disability process can be confusing and unwieldy, with many applicants waiting too long for a decision and too long to get an appeal. So in redesigning the process, the Social Security Administration is making changes that will improve the disability process at the initial level and ensure that decisions are made as accurately as possible. In redesigning the process, SSA has decided to increase its investment in the state DDS initial claims process. Our disability analysts will be required to offer face-to-face interviews to applicants, and they'll be required to write extensive rationales on those claims that are determined not eligible. The governor's recommended budget reflects the additional resources that we'll need in the DDS to carry out this redesign initiative. It was about 1 year ago that the current commissioner of the Social Security Administration decided to do a national rollout of this redesign process in July of 1999. However, just a few weeks ago, he announced that he has decided to delay the rollout and he selected 10 states to prototype the redesign process. Oregon is not among those prototype states, and the implementation of the rollout has now been delayed for us until July of 2001. Therefore, we will be submitting a technical adjustment to our budget to reflect the delay in the implementation of this national rollout. That concludes my testimony. I'd be happy to answer any questions you may have.
Other questions?
Madam Chair, I want to know, why do you want to increase the number of employees when you're reducing the number of applicants because of the new restriction that the alcohol and drug addicted people are no longer eligible?
Madam Chair, Senator Yee, let me answer that in a couple of ways, if I may. The restrictions on people that are eligible because of drug addiction and alcoholism, those people continue to apply for disability. So that workload that the DDS must process has not decreased. We still have to adjudicate those claims, but we have to adjudicate those claims in light of the new requirements that Congress has imposed. So the workload really has not diminished at all because of the legislation on drug addiction and alcoholism. Mm-hmm. The additional resources, including employees that we're requesting for the redesign process, is due to the fact that we will now have to offer face-to-face interviews to claimants. And keep in mind now we're a centralized operation. Before we did IPFO at the initial level, we have to give them the opportunity for a face-to-face interview. So that requires us to do travel that's not required now. It increases the amount of time that we'll take in processing those claims. The requirement to write extensive rationales also increases the amount of time that you need to devote toward the claim. So all of that amounts to additional resources that are required for the redesign process.
A couple of follow-up questions. Okay, Senator. So you mean you didn't have to do face-to-face interviews before?
Madam Chair, Senator, yes, that's correct. It was entirely a paper process. We have a lot of phone contact with our claimants, but there, at this point, there's no requirement to meet the claimant face-to-face in interviews.
Mm-hmm. And how long are they disqualified? I mean, you're saying they can come back and reapply again, even though they knew the rules are such that if they're addicted, they're not qualified.
Madam Chair, Senator, that is correct. If we determine that someone is not eligible for benefits, there is an appeal process that they can go through. The first level of appeal is with the state DDS, and then outside of the state DDS, they can appeal to the Federal Office of Hearings and Appeals. But at any rate, once someone has been determined not eligible at any level, they still have the right to come back and reapply and start the process all over again if they choose to do that.
That's kind of a waste of time. You tell them you're not qualified, and they come back after a couple of months. And do they get rid of their addiction when they reapply?
Madam Chair, Senator Yee, sometimes people will pick up additional disabilities. Their condition will deteriorate. There's a variety of things that could cause them to become eligible at any point in time, even though they've been denied benefits many times in the past. In the case of someone who is a drug addict or alcoholic, if their alcoholism, let's take an example, if their alcoholism has reached the point where they have cirrhosis of the liver and the damage is irreversible, even if they stop drinking, it doesn't make any difference. Their liver is failing and they're disabled. Those people will still be eligible for benefits even if they continue to drink. Once they've reached the point where that end organ damage is so severe that stopping drinking is not going to help them, then they would be entitled to receive disability benefits.
Mm-hmm. One more question.
Okay.
What is the eligibility criteria for the children to be eligible for SSI?
Madam Chair, Senator Yee, for children, it's quite complex. I'm trying to think of a way to phrase it simply, but basically, if you have some type of disability, it can be a mental or physical disability that precludes the child's ability to engage in age-appropriate activities, then they would be entitled to benefits. So it's different for a 2-year-old than it is for a 10-year-old, and different for a 15-year-old. You have to look at the impairment and how it impacts their age-appropriate activities in order to decide whether or not they're eligible for benefits.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Thank you very much, Bill. And so now, Bill, you wanted to
just kind of summarize a little bit. On pages 14, 15, and 16 of your budget synopsis, we show you the distribution. You'll note on page 14 that about 12% of the budget is general fund. 87% is federal fund, and 1% is other funds. The breakdown by program, 54% is in rehab, 38% in DDS, and 8% in administration. There's a comparison on page 15 of the budget synopsis, which compares the 97-99 LAB with 99-01 continuing service level, and then the 99-01 governor's recommended budget. The major increase, as Mr. Horsley said, in the DDS program will be changed in the reshoot, in the technical adjustment, and the the federal funds will drop, and I don't have the exact figure in front of me, but I think it's about $8 million, as well as 47 of those FTEs will be gone. So there's going to be a substantial change in the reshoot with respect to the federal funds and the FTE that is in the budget. On page 16 of the synopsis is a breakdown of the governor's recommended budget by agency and by program, breakdown of administration, rehab services, disability termination, and then the total agency. And on page 17 are the two budget notes that were placed in our budget in the last legislative session. And to summarize, I'll get to those two in just a second. To summarize, there's three issues that I'd like to reiterate to you as a committee. The first one is that what we consider to be a major issue is the situation with regard to our caseload growth. We have, as we've talked, seen a significant increase in the number of referrals and the number of persons served, and our expectation is that's going to continue. We've been able to handle that so far through efficiencies that we've implemented, many of which we discussed earlier today. If, in fact, we are unable to serve all the people that come through our door, we would have to implement what is called an order of selection. And basically what that means is that we would only serve the most severely disabled individuals and not people that we serve now. A simple way might be that most of the people we serve now have at least two disabling conditions. We might go to an order of selection that says we won't serve anybody unless they have three disabling conditions. And what that does is that means that we would serve fewer people, and that many people that deserve service would not get it, and then you get into the burdens on the other human services systems and all that goes along with that. So the caseload growth issue is an issue for us.
Bill, this pertains strictly to the rehab services.
Yes.
It's not,
I'm sorry.
To the
John, that is correct. I'm sorry, Madam Chair, members, I'm sorry. The other two issues relate to the budget notes, which are described to you on page 17. The first one relates to a fully matched budget. As we talked earlier during the last three biennia, the budget included a transfer of funds to the division from the workers' benefit fund. And in the past session, the division's budget included about $750,000 there, which matched an additional $3 million federal funds at that close to 4-to-1 rate. As John indicated in his preliminary remarks, the Management Labor Advisory Committee of the Department of Consumer and Business Services recommended these funds not be continued in the 9901 governor's budget. The governor's budget does fully match the Rehabilitation Services Program if the backfill that is in Program Option Package 113 in the SDSD budget, which is the Employment Initiative Package, is funded. This will fully match our budget. Without that package, we would have a problem because there are nine FTE that are involved, that were involved with the workers' comp money that we got, and they are positions that are full and are serving at least 2,000 people right now. So that is a very important issue to us. The third issue relates to the funding split, which John had also mentioned, and that is that the budget note is there, and it asks that this be looked at in terms of what might be a different split between the funding for the commission and funding for the general agency, which is what we would be called. And the DOS's review recommended no change in this allocation, but that a final decision had to be made. In fact, I think if I remember Mr. Yonker's quote, he said both agencies need to have more money, not less. At any rate, any change in the federal funding mix would necessitate
budget and or service reduction for one of the two agencies and less services to people with certain kinds of disabilities. So it's a decision that that needs to be discussed, and hopefully a decision would be made either in the work sessions or at some point before the end of the session. That concludes our testimony on behalf of the budget. If you have any other questions, we'd be happy to answer them, and if not, I thank you very much for the opportunity to present our budget to you today.
Thank you. Representative Ross.
Just one brief question. Is there more federal money available to go into your program if the state provides more match?
There's only the amount of match that's available, Representative Ross, to the states is based on population. So Oregon's allocation is about 1%. So there's that amount, and there's no additional federal match on top of that.
Madam Chair, members of the subcommittee, my name is Lisa Pearson with the Department of Administrative Services. I'm going to be very quick. You should have a document in front of you, which is our standard format. The governor's recommended budget for the Vocational Rehabilitation Division is 12.5% higher than the 1997-99 legislatively approved budget. And this is primarily due to increases in the federal funding that were discussed for the Disability Determination Service. Otherwise, it funds the current service level. At the bottom of the first page is a discussion of how the budget was developed. It started with a legislatively adopted budget, which was about $98 million total funds, $12 million general fund, and has 400 positions. Turning to the top of page 2 on the back, emergency board actions through April were included in the governor's recommended budget. These include a salary plan adjustment and two rebalance efforts that came through in January and April of 1998. Significant current service level adjustments included the phase out of the workers' compensation funding that has already been talked about. In addition, there were some one-time costs, including some systems furniture and a building redesign, which has been removed. Also, the disability determination services and supplies were increased for a full biennium's worth of funding. And this was because some positions were added partway through this biennium, and so they need to have full biennium's worth of funding to go along with that. And then in addition, there was a mandated caseload increase. This is for the disability determination service, and this is the package that Lloyd Horsley talked about that will be adjusted when we get to work session. Okay. There's one policy package which has to do with the DHR Director's Office prorate, and this is standard across all divisions. Additional funding is needed for year 2000 remediation, computer network support, and internal auditors. And as with all DHR division budgets, we will be presenting different adjustments during the rebalance and reshoot period, and the reshoot is the governor's revised budget.
Lisa, thank you for the disability determination. You said it will be adjusted. I heard Lloyd say that it would be, it's going to be delayed. Are you removing all of this, or?
Madam Chair,
setting it aside.
That would be the $8 million figure that they had just discussed in the,
okay.
And I can't remember the FTE, 47048.
Okay. Short memory.
Mr. Chairman, I have a question for Mr. Brown, because I remember when the emergency board or sometimes the department came in and asked for federal funding as a grant to do a demonstration project to see if you can allow people with disability to make more income than was allowed without losing their Medicaid.
Right.
Because a lot of them, they don't want to lose their Medicaid, but yet they want to make more income whenever they have the opportunity. I just want to know what is the progress or the result of that.
Madam Chair, Senator Yee, we have an expert in that program sitting right here. I'd like to have Lene tell you.
Again, for the record,
it sounds like a good idea.
Yeah, I'm Lene Rutledge. Senator Kutub, Senator Yee, it is a great idea. It's a 5-year grant that comes from the Rehabilitation Services Administration. It provides us with resources so that we can help people be able to buy into Medicaid so they can keep those real essential benefits of health care and long-term services and go to work. And we have probably 35 people that are already enrolled, so they're already working, and we're able to demonstrate that people with severe disabilities, when they know that they won't lose their benefits, they're choosing the option of employment over benefits. So we've already started. We have 35 people enrolled. We are doing it slowly so that we can fully explain to people what the possible impacts will be so that we can train our staff. But we anticipate by the end of the year that we'll have a couple hundred people who are enrolled.
Mm-hmm. Another question, yes. Madam Chair. Is there a limit to the number of people who can enroll in the program?
So the chief have said, no, there's no limits. We originally thought of it as a demonstration, but we really have gone statewide. We have no limit on the number of people.
Mm-hmm. So all they do is contact you that are interested in participating in this program.
Correct. They could contact us. They could contact the Senior and Disabled Services Division.
Well, just for the committee's information, I have a constituent who is a quadriplegic. But he said one of those motivation speakers, very good motivation speaker, tells the young people what his problem was, but he is very motivated even with all his problems. So he can make a lot of money.
Yeah.
But he was kind of limited to the amount of
money. That's exactly the example. You'll hear from at least one person tomorrow who's in the program. So you'll be able to hear a testimonial from a person who was able to make that choice and is now employed.
Oh, maybe I can invite him to come and speak.
Sure.
Mm-hmm. Okay, and that will be tomorrow. That's the public hearing. Thank you very much for your presentation. If there are no further questions, we will have the Blind Commission. Now give their presentation. I'm sorry. And John, you already went over.
Yeah.
Both.
That's
correct. Right. Lisa will be our CAS Alan?
The Phil.
Good afternoon. Charles Young.
Madam Chairman, I'm Charles Young, the Administrator of the Commission for the Blind, and I'm here to talk to you basically about a current service level budget for the Oregon Commission for the Blind. But briefly, I'm going to ask you to do an exercise with me. I want you to imagine suddenly losing your ability to travel independently, to walk to a store or a public park or the library. I want you to also, if you would, imagine suddenly losing your ability to cook, to clean, or maintain your home. And then finally, I would like you to imagine suddenly losing your ability to read and write or be literate. And now I'd like you to imagine suddenly getting all this restored to yourself and more. Being assisted after having your vision restored, or your ability to cook and clean and maintain your home, and that being assisted to identify a career, to be provided training and employment, and receive help in acquiring a job. This is what the Oregon Commission for the Blind is about, helping blind Oregonians learn how to or relearn how to travel independently, learn how to cook, clean, and maintain a home, and learn how to become literate again. And more, we also work with people on how to be competitive in today's economy, using the latest in technology designed to enable visually impaired and blind citizens to fully participate in the workforce. Now I want to introduce or talk about several individuals who are either here with me today or will be here tomorrow for the public hearing. They will be available, like I say, either today or tomorrow to meet with you. The first one is Ms. Mary Ann Topolowski, who will be here tomorrow. And she would share with you how, when she moved here from Michigan 3 years ago, we taught her how to travel, we taught her how to maintain an apartment, and more, we taught her the adaptive technology that has enabled her now to have a job. I would like to talk about Mrs. Charlene Cook, who's here with us in the back of the room today. She's the owner of the very successful Cranford Flower Shop in Portland. She will share with you about how, upon graduating from high school, she learned from us how to be literate using Braille, using reading and writing Braille. Mrs. Cook has been self-employed ever since. But more, she comes to us on occasion now for advice and tutoring the latest technology to enable her to continue to manage her successful florist business. Mr. Mike Bullis is with us also today, and he grew up learning firsthand the struggles of attaining employment as a blind person in our society. But now he's the boss. He owns his own business, the Kaleidoscope Tavern here in Salem. And ironically, now he struggles to find good employees. With some initial assistance from us years back, he became a demonstration person, if you will, a pioneer with technology. But now as a taxpayer, and occasionally with advice from us, he can afford to purchase his own technology and to stay competitive in the business world. All of these successfully employed blind individuals are able to work and pay taxes because they received basic training in cane travel, home maintenance and literacy, or the reading and writing of Braille. This was followed by career counseling, job development, or self-owned business assistance. But more, these people receive ongoing assistance in how to identify and use the latest technology in order to compete in today's economy. Next, I want to mention two former members of this legislative body. Former Senator Ken Jernstead, who's in the front row here and is now Commissioner of the Oregon Commission for the Blind, and former Senator Monroe Sweetland will be with us tomorrow afternoon. These two gentlemen are of differing political persuasions. While Senator Jernstead chooses to travel using a guide dog, Senator Sweetland prefers a white cane. While one prefers to live in a moderate-sized rural community, the other prefers an urban setting. But more importantly, both agree that the training to travel, to be literate, and live independently should be available to all newly visually impaired older citizens. This training, on average, costs us $450 per student and is delivered in the student's home and will minimize the dependency on their family and friends and more, reduce premature referral to nursing home care. These two gentlemen are representative of the rapidly growing population of older Oregonians with severe visual impairments. All five of the individuals I mentioned will share their experiences with us either today or tomorrow. Whether these individuals need training to maintain their independence and dignity or as a prerequisite for going to work, all five will attest to this extreme value of this agency and more the importance of being contributing and participating members of our society. All five seek your support for the agency budget and more can attest to how the Commission for the Blind, through proper training to deal with vision loss and the appropriate technology, can change what it means to be blind in our society. So with that, I'll either let you question me or the witnesses.
Okay. Are there any questions for Mr. Young? If not, why don't we allow some witnesses? Is that what you want to do at this
point? Mrs. Cook is with us here today. Senator Jernstead is with us here today. Mr. Bullis is available today. The others will be here tomorrow. So if that fits your schedule.
Okay.
Thank you. Sometimes it seems to me that this might be more fun than the position that you people find yourself in at budget time. Well do I remember. Good to see you that I know and good to make the acquaintances you that I don't know, but I have been recently appointed to, well, about a year ago, I was appointed to the Commission for the Blind by Governor Kitzhaber to fill out a term. I guess I behaved fairly decently because now he's asking me to take a full term on the commission, which I have agreed to do. I do face that terrible hurdle of having to be passed by the Senate, but I'll struggle through that, I guess. I have been absolutely amazed at what I have learned this last year with the Blind Commission. It is one of the outstanding, I think, organizations in the state, and makes me kind of wish I'd done a little bit more for them when I was in the legislature, but here I am. I don't know whether everybody realizes it or not, but to get a guide dog, you have to pass a course in mobility, and that is learning to use the cane before you can go to what I call dog college, which is up in East Multnomah County now. Guide Dogs for the Blind, as you may or may not know, has a branch institution up there, and it is a beautiful, beautiful place, and I think a real asset for that community and the state, and especially for those of us that are find themselves in the position of obtaining guide dogs. And to be eligible to go to dog college, you have to, of course, be legally blind, and which I am, and get a few people to swear by you to a certain extent. And then the one thing that's required before they let you start working with a dog is take a course in mobility. And that is given by the commission, Blind Commission. And I was absolutely amazed at the service I received. At that time, I wasn't even thinking about being on the commission. And they certainly went out of their way to educate me with the stick. And I have to say that what I learned with that stick gave me a lot of confidence. And, of course, I love my dog, and I think he thinks a little bit of me. My wife thinks that I think more of my dog than I do her, but I don't want to debate that one here. The things that I learned gave me a lot of confidence, and it helps me to this point. And I know that if I would suddenly lose my dog, I would want another one. But that cane work and the things that are taught on the side of getting along in the home and getting in and out of cars and elevators and all that stuff, I really learned from the commission. And I certainly appreciated the way they took care of me. And at that point in time, they never dreamt that at one time I was going to be on the commission. Of course, being on the commission, we don't give orders to this guy. He kind of tells and suggests that we come along and do some of these things, and we do it. And it's a very outstanding group of people, I think, and I'm enjoying working with them. I would be glad to try to answer any questions you might have, but I certainly recommend that you pay real strict attention to the budget. That's all I can say.
Thank you, Senator. Representative Wilson.
Thank you. Senator Jernstedt, you probably remember Monroe Sweetland.
Oh, yes.
And his political persuasion. I just wondered if it was by design that you came on separate days.
No way. No way. I had heard of Mr. Sweetland before I ever hit the legislature. I want you to know that I'm a young kid compared to that gentleman.
I know you are. I know him very well. In fact, he ran for again in this.
I realize this. I'm amazed at him.
He's over 90.
Our paths have crossed several times, and I have nothing but admiration for him.
I should say. Are there other questions? If not, we certainly thank you for coming and testifying today about this fine commission. We will keep our eyes on this budget.
Good. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, Senator Sweetland informed me he will be a good witness for us tomorrow because all the enemies he made while in the legislature, he's outlived. So,
I'm still here, but I wasn't in the legislature when he was here. He is running in my district. I know very well. And he's a very active person.
I asked Senator Jernstead to speak because he and Senator Sweetler are representative of the older blind population that we work with. Severe visual impairment is the third most common disabling condition of older Americans, and it's, as we live longer, it's increasing very rapidly, and so this is a very large population of newly visual impaired and blind individuals. I have two working individuals here. We'll talk about our vocational program, our work program, if I could. I would probably like to start with Mrs. Charlene Cook, who owns the very successful Cranford Forest, and somebody who also will probably mention the need for technology to stay competitive in today's business world. Mrs. Cook.
Thank you very much, and that was very hard to follow. But my story is very different from the senators, and just to give you a little bit of background, I started to lose my sight when I was 7 years old in the public school, and my parents had three children younger than I, and certainly had their hands full with life, let alone raising a blind child. And I found myself at the Commission for the Blind, having graduated from high school, reading and writing on a fourth grade level. I was illiterate. And that was so hard on my ego because I had a big one. And, I learned there at that agency to read and write. And what can you possibly do with your life without literacy? And I will be eternally grateful to that agency for that, and a man particularly who was my counselor who passed away influenced my life greatly. And I want to say one other thing, and this is just a statement, but somebody who was employed by the Commission for the Blind said this to me, and it has impacted my life greatly. And he was speaking to a group of us, and we were all blind or visually impaired. And he said to us, are you allowing the amount of vision that you have to dictate to you your self-worth? And, it hit me between the eyes because I have decreasing vision and now have just a tiny bit of light perception. I thought, oh, my word. If I'm going to allow my self-worth to be dictated to me by the amount of vision I have, I'm headed for the skids. And, I wanted to say that to you today because not only did I learn to read and write at the Commission for the Blind, I also had philosophy handed to me that has carried me through my life. And we live by the philosophy that we believe in, and I believe so strongly that there's just the highest quality of life available to people after blindness if you have the skills and the training and the tools that you need to make that happen. I was self-employed for a long time in my own food service business, and then about 15 years ago, my husband and I bought a flower business, which we own and operate. And it's the age of computer, and for me, when the technology that's available in the world today brought the printed page, the words off the printed page to be into a computer, and therefore I could access that with speech or braille, therefore I could read and write anything that was normally not available to me unless it was transcribed. That was the key to vocational and the key to my business being much more easily ran than when I was, and I came from the days where you had everything transcribed into braille. So today, the world of job opportunities are opened 100-fold by the ability for blind people to read and write print, which they were not able to do even 15 years ago. And I brought, this is just a little show and tell, this little machine here, it's about the size of a pound of butter. It's called Braille and Speak, and they sell for $15,000, $2,000. This is a that you enter in Braille and it speaks out verbally. I'll just give you just a tiny bit of it. The voice can be very annoying, so, okay. I'm just going to write my name. Now, I entered in Braille. It spoke to me what I entered. It also stores the data, and then back at my office, I have a computer, regular keyboard and all that, and I can connect it to the computer and dump it into my computer, scan in written documents, read it out from the voice. You know, it's just been everything to me. And, you know, I want to close and say the four children that my parents were raising, as it turned out, my youngest sister also was born with the same eye disease that I have, which is retinitis pigmentosa. And she also went through the school system as a blind child. And had her life took a total different road than my life, but she just graduated from Mount Hood Community College after going back to school. She's a medical transcriber. She raised three children as a single mom and has been established with a computer that has voice access. And this is in totally because the Commission for the Blind believes that there is life after blindness. And then I'm here also to plug the budget because this is a $2,000 machine versus the old-fashioned Braille writer, which probably you could get for $300. So, you know, life does become more expensive, but I will be eternally grateful to the state of Oregon that my life has been successful because of their philosophy and their dollars that brought quality of life to me. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Are there questions?
Senator Yee has a question of Charlene. I want her to go first. Actually, some of what Mr. Young and Charlene said stimulated the question that I'd like to ask of the senator. But since Charlene's there,
okay. Senator Yee.
I just want to know if the commission did a training for you in using the computer and provided the computer to you also.
Actually, I will say they gave me training, yes. I bought my own because I had already gone on to be self-employed and fortunately was taken off the disability rolls. But the training I got at the Commission for the Blind, and they offered it freely to me. There's a marvelous tech center, and I wasn't a client, but I was able to go back and get the training I needed. And Senator Yee, I'm about to go into the year 2000 with, of course, the computer equipment that they tell me isn't going to go with me. So I'm back knocking on the door of the Commission for the Blind, and they've offered to show me what's available and give me training so that I can make choices on the equipment that I need to purchase.
And they didn't pay for the equipment?
They did not. Fortunately, I was able to do that myself, and I was grateful for that.
For Mr. Young. So for the ones who can afford the computer, can the commission provide the computer for them?
Senator Yee, we would purchase the equipment if there was no way else for them to purchase it. If they were unemployed and the employer that we were working with refused to buy it or could not afford it, then we would purchase it. But we would first look to see if the employer could afford the equipment that we'd need. In Mrs. Cook's case, she's self-employed. She owns her own business, but she was successful after this technology came available. So now we teach her how to use it, but she purchases the technology herself. But she can't get this training anywhere. You know, we're the only provider of the training. So we provide the training, she buys the equipment. If she was out of work and not able to afford the equipment, then we would consider that as an option. Mm-hmm. But that's not the case with Mrs. Cook.
Okay. And Senator.
Okay to ask Senator Grimstad could come back.
Thank you.
You're very welcome. Thank you.
Okay, yeah.
As long as you were in the room at the time.
I was in the room at the time.
Good.
I was in the room at the time, actually, but what was said after you left the podium, Senator Grimstad, was Mr. Young was talking about how blindness fits the elderly, and that is a relatively new dynamic, I guess, as people live longer and so on. Is that what we're driving at? But given all of that, and given that Charlene just got through telling us that blindness came on her at the age of 7, I was hoping maybe you'd tell us a little bit about the onset of your own blindness and when that occurred and some of the adjustments that that required.
Well, I'm certainly glad that you called me back up here because I kind of was shooting from the hip at first, and I still am really, but I realize sitting here that there's a lot more that I should have said, especially about some of this training that the commission is giving elderly people, blind elderly people in their homes. I know of several older ladies, older than I am, if that's possible, but that live near me that have received training from the commission just to adjust to living alone in their home. And I've known one story where the person had helped this person for the third time, had gone to the home and rearranged her spices and everything and showed her. I don't know exactly what they do, but I know they work with these people until they are confident in their own home. And as she left, this person thanked her very much, and then the teacher said, of course, you probably didn't know it, but I'm blind also. The instructor was out in the community, a blind person giving another blind person this very much needed help. In my own case, when you get as old as I am, well, in the first place, I lived dangerously. I was a member of the legislature, and I've done a few things in my life where I never thought I'd ever be this old, much less not being able to see at this age. I have reached the present age, and now I'm shooting for another decade or so. But I was surprised. The adjustment in my case has been so very gradual. I lost complete vision in one eye and then had glaucoma in the other eye. And then my bum eye became my only eye, and it gets worse as I get older. I'm not kidding myself. But the fact that the commission has helped me so much, and now I'm on the commission, and I'm getting more and more aware of the different cases around the state where we actually need more people, especially out in the rural area. That's the same old song that we've heard all the time as members of the legislature. But it is true, there are people out there that need the help, and it's amazing to me that this help, much needed help, can be purchased so at such a low price. And I tell you, this force teaching someone to take care of themselves for $400 is certainly a lot better than putting somebody in a home for $2,000 a month. And most older people would like to stay in their own home. And with a little encouragement from the commission and some guidance and real help by people that know what they're doing, it's one of the best buys in the state of Oregon.
So this is really pretty different than the training that older people get, is really pretty different than the training that younger adults get. I had kind of seen a one-size-fits-all kind of approach by the agency, but it's not really that at all.
Ms. Chairman, if I might, the training is almost the same. It's the extent of the training. The backup of the four leading causes of blindness, three of them are age-related. Three are age-related onset: macular degeneration, cataracts, diabetes, and glaucoma. Macular degeneration, cataracts, and glaucoma are all age-related. They're diseases primarily of older individuals, although there are cases of babies with diseases, but they're usually in the older years. So the leading cause of three of the four leading causes of blindness are age related. The type of training we provide to the younger blind, the working age blind, or those who express a desire to go to work is oftentimes the same as we do the older. It's just the extent. We teach older blind people enough travel training to get to the local church and down to the local store.
We teach working age blind people enough training so they could go to Paris on public transportation from Oregon if they needed to, or get to anywhere in the world, you know, because they might have to, a business need to do that. The older blind people often don't want that extended training. That's why we can train the older blind people in their homes for a mere $450 on average. We teach them enough cooking techniques to just cook and maintain their home. We teach them simply on a gas stove, on their stove, that they're familiar with. Younger people, we teach them how to use any stove, electric, gas, what have you. So it's the extent of the training.
And Mr. Young, that is a great segue into my question, which is, are you going to go over your program?
I could do very much. Very much. If you'd like me to do that.
I'm giving a presentation.
On this.
It won't be today because we've got 4 minutes left.
Right.
We may have, yes, tomorrow is actually the public testimony
right.
day. And if one of the witnesses come for today, what you might plan on doing for tomorrow is plan a very succinct overview of your program so that when our witnesses come forward, we have a little bit better understanding of the commission.
Okay.
So that, you know, some of the questions we ask are not backwards. We're asking things that if we had had a presentation, then we would have had maybe a more intelligent question or maybe would have had a little bit more understanding. I do appreciate the witnesses coming and telling us. It does give us a depth of information and understanding that we would not otherwise have. But with that, do we have one more witness for today?
Chairman, I'll bring the witnesses back tomorrow. Okay. That could be arranged.
Okay. All right. Well, I appreciate that. Again, I do appreciate you witnesses being here and telling us of your success. And Senator Jernstedt. I didn't see it spelled. So
a lot of people do a lot worse than that.
Well, thank you for being here and actually serving on the commission as well. And Mrs. Cook, kudos to you.
Just for fun, I would like to say that I wish that, looking back on my, I spent a couple of days around here, I wish that at least one time during that time I had visited the commission offices there in Portland.
Mm-hmm.
That is a real education for anybody to be able to see that and see the different types of equipment that's available. Mm-hmm. And the services that go out of that place, it's amazing. Mm-hmm. So, as a member of the commission, I welcome you all to come.
Thank you for that invitation.
When he said a couple of days, Senator, how many years were you here?
No, he didn't. You mean?
He was joking. But I
mean, I've got to
serve?
22 years.
That's what I was driving at.
Okay. Well, with that, we are going to adjourn our committee meeting for today and reconvene tomorrow at 1 o'clock. Thank you very much.